In his novel, Dr. Sacks, Jack Kerouac writes of his boyhood days in Lowell, Massachusetts in the late 1920s and early 1930s. This is one of five novels that he wrote that are based on his early life in Lowell. And in Dr. Sacks, the writer devotes a short chapter to describing his birth. It's a passage that has now been read hundreds, if not thousands, of times by people standing in front of the Lupine Road double-decker, where it all took place over 85 years ago. This is a house where people still live, and I think over the years they've gotten used to little clumps of people standing in front of their home reading a passage from Dr. Sacks. This is just a portion of it. It was in Centerville I was born, across the wide basin to the hill on Lupine Road, March 1922, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon of a red all over supper time, as drowsily beers were tapped in Newby and Lakeview saloons, and the river rushed with her cargoes of ice, and lazily pieces of snow dropped plump from bagging branches. Well, up to this point, you're reading along on this, it all sounds very quite plausible. For an early March in Lowell in 1922, you've got a red glowing late afternoon sun. You've got workers stopping off at a saloon for a drink on their way home from the mills. You've got the rush and the roar of the Merrimack River, snow falling off branches and such as that. But then a few lines later, the narrative shifts, moves into another zone of reality. The point of view also shifts to that of Kerouac's mother immediately after her son's grand entry into the world. Get this. Golden birds hovered over her and me as she hugged me to her breast. Angels and cherubs made a dance and floated from the ceiling, and there was a mist of butterflies and birds and moths. What in the world is this all about? How do we get from such real-world things as saloons and snow and ice-filled river to golden birds and dancing angels and cherubs hovering over Gabriel Kerouac and her newborn son? As many times as I read this passage, I still get a kick out of it. And I usually find myself saying something like, come on, Kerouac, get over yourself. Your birth was no different from that of any of the rest of us. What I also become aware of when I read this passage, you may have picked up on it yourself, is there are certain parallels between it and another birth narrative. In this one, the story goes from such real-world events as shepherds tending sheep and animals settling in for the night in a barn where a young mother is birthing her first baby, to such celestial events as angels in the sky and bright lights and a supersized star hovering over the barn where the birth is happening, and then sometime later there's this visit from astrologers who were convinced that something of cosmic significance had happened. Back to Kerouac for just a second. He was raised a devout Catholic, and while he wavered from it now and then, he still remained identified with that faith throughout his life. And so what he does, he mythologizes his own birth in Dr. Sacks by drawing on some of the images from the birth mythology of his faith tradition. Now, whether he saw himself as some kind of a literary messiah, he's kind of announcing his birth in this kind of an anointed sort of a way, or whether he was just having a little bit of fun with the imagery from the faith tradition in which he was raised, well, that could be debated either way, I guess, and believe it or not, I have participated in such debates that have gone on for a long time. I guess, you know, some of us need a life more than others. But the larger point I'm working toward here, now that you've indulged me my Kerouac moment this morning, is that the story of a miraculous or fanciful or mythological birth on the part of his founder is quite common to a number of religious traditions. David touched on that in his words for reflection. And the images and the stories from those legends become drawn upon in any number of ways. So I'm going to do for us for the next few minutes here just a little brief exercise in comparative religion as a way of expanding upon that point, saying a little more about this theme of miraculous births. The birth of the Buddha was foretold to his mother, a royal Indian, Queen Maya, in a dream, in which she saw a pure white elephant bearing a lotus flower. When she took the flower, she saw a great light, the earth shook, and throughout the land the blind were able to see, the lame were able to walk, music was heard, and lotus flowers bloomed abundantly. That must have been quite the dream. So she asked her palace counselors to help her interpret this dream, and they told the queen that she was going to give birth to a son, who would either become a royal ruler himself, or a great teacher, or maybe both. Those of you with a Catholic background may hear some overtones from the Annunciation of Mary in that account, a little more grandiose, but the same kind of idea. And in the Buddha story itself, young Gautama renounces his kingly status to live a simple life as a beggar, and then as a teacher who taught the ways of enlightenment that have become the basis for Buddhist practice. Move over a country to China, you get Confucius. And with him, it was a unicorn who visited his mother. She was also of a ruling family in China, to tell her she would give birth to the son of the Great Spirit, who would become a master teacher and ruler in China. In a way similar to that of the Buddha, Confucius turned his back on any kind of political rule, became a teacher of wisdom for the rich and the poor, the high and the low. One of his core messages was that self-rule is an essential thing if one is going to rule others. There are no, that I'm aware of, similar supernatural or fanciful occurrences associated with the birth of Muhammad, but there is the more general affirmation among the Islamic people that God had prepared him, even as an infant, to be the recipient and the messenger of the divine word. And there's also, for those raised in Judaic and Christian faiths, you know this, a decided element of both fantasy and royalty in the Moses story. The legend is that he was born of Hebrew parents and into slavery in Egypt at a time when the Pharaoh had ordered all the male infants to be drowned in the Nile. I'm not exactly sure what the Pharaoh was planning to use or who or what he was planning to use for slaves if he was drowning off all of the male infants. But that was his call. I went back and reread the passage and couldn't figure out why it was that he did that other than he did. To avoid such a fate for her newborn son, Moses' mother hides him in a basket in some reeds near the river. There he is found by one of Pharaoh's daughters, who adopts him and has him raised in the palaces of Egypt. The story continues then. The baby grows up, learns of his true identity, leaves his Pharaoh-like trappings, and becomes the liberator of his people. Well, each of these stories contain far more rich and intricate and fascinating detail than we have time to cover today. I do plead guilty to giving them a rather superficial treatment here this morning. But I wanted to take this admittedly very sort of quick trip around the bases as a way of putting the story or the legend or the myth of the birth of Jesus into a larger and more universal setting. Because while his birth story is not identical to any of the stories here I've just alluded to, there are certain elements of each one of those that are found in that story. There is the fanciful and supernatural announcement of his impending birth, and fanciful celestial events when it happens. And while Jesus was not born into royalty in the way that Buddha or Confucius was, he came instead from the peasant class of his society. His ministry is launched, as another piece of his legend has it, after he renounces the temptation of the devil to gain great earthly power and might, such as an earthly king might have. He turns his back on that and becomes instead a simple teacher of wisdom, mostly to the Jewish peasant people from which he came. Well, I reflect on these things at this time of the year. And as I do so, the question for me is not so much, did all these things really happen? Are they true? As in, do they have any kind of historical validity, since for the most part they don't? The question I like to ask instead is, why do we as a human race keep telling them? Why do we keep telling them? In all their various versions and expressions, in such far-flung parts of the world. In order for that to happen, it means stories like these must be striking some kind of a resonant chord. To say that these stories were just made up may well be true in the sense that they are products of human beings, but that just begs the larger question of why were they made up? Why were they produced? What human needs and yearnings and aspirations do they address and fulfill? So I'm going to focus in now on the Jesus birth story or legend or myth as a way of at least trying to get at some of those kinds of questions. And I take a cue here from the Unitarian Universalist minister, Reverend Jack Mendelsohn. A number of years ago, he wrote a book called Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age, and he devotes a chapter of that to the place of Jesus in the Unitarian Universalist tradition. And in that chapter, he writes, "To me, the important thing about Jesus is not that he was just human, but that the human race is capable of producing him. And not just him, but others like him. And not only in ancient times, but now." Well, I think of Jack's words when it comes to how I observe or reflect upon the birth of Jesus. As already noted, the accounts of his birth are a mixture of legend and myth, although their historical setting is reasonably accurate. And Mendelsohn, when he says that quote I just cited, Mendelsohn, he is not belittling or dismissing the stories of Jesus, birth and all, but rather he is saying we should see something very positive in the fact that humanity is capable of putting forth such persons and such stories which exemplify the best in humanity. We human beings, that is to say, seem to have a need for an image of an ideal human being. An ideal human being whose ways we can kind of aspire towards. And that, I feel, is where these stories I've been referring to, all of them, I think that is where they ultimately come from. In some stories or myths, these ideal human beings, as we've seen, are given affectations of royalty or kingly type of powers. And I think that's because those who were telling them that represented a kind of an exalted position. Some of these idealized human beings were given superhuman qualities to the point of their being gods or quasi-gods themselves. Indeed, in the Greco-Roman world into which Jesus was born, there was really nothing exceptional or unusual about the union of a god with a human being that produced an extraordinary individual who embodied godlike qualities. For the first century church to maintain that Jesus was the result of the union of God with a young woman was really not all that inconsistent with the worldview of that time. Now, this does create a problem for biblical literalists because they try to shoehorn a first century worldview and cosmology, which I'm sure worked very well in the first century, but they are trying to shoehorn a first century worldview or cosmology into a 21st century worldview or cosmology. And that can leave one having to believe some rather weird things. But we'll leave that be. This Wednesday evening, at our Christmas Eve story, we will hear the very beautiful and poetic account of the legend of Jesus' birth as told in the Gospel of Luke. I will offer a little bit here of what I take from that account, and then I'm going to save some for Wednesday evening as well. Well, one piece of insight for me that I glean from the story or the myth of a baby through whom God arrives is an affirmation of the power and the potentiality of human life. It's saying that we human beings possess within ourselves the capability of moving towards this idealized human being that we are putting out there and telling this story about. And for all of the issues that I have and I did come to have with Christian theology, which eventually became enough to get me into the Unitarian Universalist ministry, I still find it intriguing But at the heart of that theology is the story or the legend or the myth of a God who arrives not as a supernatural force, but rather as a quite simple human being who spent his life trying to show other human beings how to be more positively human. Because for all of the supernatural aura that surrounds this story, it is still a very fragile human and quite natural child who remains its centerpiece. And what the image of this, or the metaphor of this God-child metaphor suggests to me, as a religious humanist, is that all I need when it comes to finding meaning and power and purpose and depth and relatedness in my life, that has already been given to me. And I still, even at my age, I know I have not opened up that whole package of possibility, that whole package of potentiality. I keep working on it. I know it is still there. The story of a child in whom the highest arrives as yet another traveler with us on the common human way is both a simple and profound statement all at the same time. For it reminds us, as I say, that all we need for our personal and shared journeys through our lives is already here with us, if we can access that and then get up and move on. The story or the legend of a completely human child who also embodies all the qualities of the highest is a reminder, as I say, that we human beings as well have those qualities within us if we can learn how to reach them and then bring them out. This is a story that also recalls some of the words of the late great scholar of mythology, Joseph Campbell, in his conversations with Bill Moyers many years ago in that PBS series called The Power of Myth. In one of their discussions, Dr. Campbell said, "All the gods, all the heavens, all the worlds are within us." And that, in a nutshell, is why we as a human race have created the kinds of stories that lie at the heart of many, if not all, of the world's religious traditions. It is because all the gods, all the heavens, all the worlds lie within us. And the stories that we tell here and all around the world in their various versions and expressions, these stories are our way of getting at those gods, those heavens, those worlds that are within us. It's a way of getting them out where we can see them and hear them and better understand their meaning and then aspire towards which they call us to. So I've offered a piece of the message that I find in one of those stories this morning. It happens to be the story with which I'm most familiar since I have heard it throughout my life. And yet it is a message I feel that transcends the faith in which it is rooted. It is a story that was created, even made up, if you will, but done so in the very best sense of that term. It is a story that we have produced to remind ourselves of who we are and who we may yet become. So with that in mind, let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 228, Once in Royal David City.